Welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Bombercast, fresh off a win off the GWS Giants. I'm your regular co-host, The Grizz, and joining me today is not just my regular co-host in Bonta 34, it's everyone's favourite guest host, Fair Bump Play On. How are we, lads?
Very well, thanks, Grizz. How you going?
I'm all right, how are you, Bonts?
I'm good, mate. A very unexpected victory, although I did tip us last week, Grizz, and you laughed at me when I tipped us, so I'd just like to get that out there really early in the piece.
Well, I'd just like to say every time I tip against Essendon, they win. I'm just going to keep doing it for the rest of the year, I reckon. And
if you tip against us for North Melbourne, I will whack you over the head. There's no way you could possibly tip North Melbourne this weekend.
Not even I could jinx us in that circumstance. But we'll get to North Melbourne in a bit. We will talk about, obviously, the big win on the weekend, which was Essendon's 82-62 win over the GWS Giants. A casual, I read the stat, it was like a 152-156-point turnaround from the last time we played them, which is, it's sort of beggars belief. It probably just shows how poor we were towards back end of last year. But we'll jump straight into it, Fair Bump. We might just go to you first. But I just thought that this was an incredibly well-rounded performance. There was, you know, one or two star contributors, you know, Cole Langford and Nick Martin spring to mind. But generally speaking, particularly in the second half, we had, you know, 22 really solid contributors across the park.
Great to see, wasn't it? And pressure. Pressure is the word that comes to mind when you see just constant pressure on the ball. It makes me so pleased to be watching a side win, lose, or draw, really. If they turn up like that, it's very, very enjoyable to watch. And I think you only get that kind of pressure if everyone turns up to play.
I think you're right, mate. I think with the pressure there, you start with the tackles. So we did actually lose the tackle battle, but I actually thought during the game that it looked like we were sticking them more than everyone else. And if you look at tackles inside forward 50, we actually led 13-10. And I think tackles inside forward 50, Grizz, is probably something we've all been screaming a little bit about, because it had felt like teams walked their way out of our forward 50 the last few weeks, but that certainly didn't happen against the Giants.
Yeah, and I think so much was said early on in the season and probably the last couple of years about our transition defense, and you can just see the difference that it makes for the guys defending the middle part of the ground in that press we like to play when there's heat on the ball, when the opposition trying to get it out. And, you know, the Giants really are the gold standard when it comes to transition football. Like, they are custom built to just plow through sides in terms of running the ball through the middle, and using, you know, chain of hands to get that ball moving. And if there was one team that was going to just sort of test our team defense, it was going to be the Giants. And they showed us, you know, we don't need to look too far back to remember that this team touched us up by 130 points last year when our pressure was at its worst. So, you know, that's what it does, this level of pressure. And, you know, you can see guys like Dyson Heppel and Jaden Laverty, who struggled at times last year when the ball was coming in with no pressure, just look a lot better behind the ball when they have time to get in a zone and time to read the play when there's heat on the ball or it's coming in a little bit dirty.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It makes someone like Heppel, it hides his speed, doesn't it, really? Because if you think about a backline of Laverty, Heppel, and even Jake Kelly, it's not quick, but that doesn't seem to matter so much this year.
Yeah, when you think it back to the second last round last year, you see Heppel, one of many, just almost helpless. If you're defending on a day like that when the opposition's just walking it through the middle of the ground at will, not that they were walking, the tsunami was in full effect. It's chalk and cheese. And credit to Heppel for getting his body right and being in good shape, but we've made it a lot easier for him this year.
I think it's probably good now if we turn to the forward line, where I think we were talking about sort of pressure on the forward line, but the way the forward line functioned as a unit I thought was really strong. So we'll talk about Kyle Langford in a minute in terms of his scoring output. But one thing I just wanted to hit on, and there's been a bit of chat about this guy's sort of stats. It was really interesting to see Peter Wright's game on the weekend. He didn't have a lot of stats, but Sam Taylor went to him and was playing back shoulder. And I think Nathan Buckley and Jason Dunstall, who were doing the call for Fox, both said the same thing, which was he did a lot of selfless running to draw Sam Taylor out of the defensive 50, and he wasn't zoning off to intercept like he normally does. And then that means you're getting Cole Langford one-on-one deep against guys like Jack Buckley or Connor Iden that he's probably going to beat one-on-one. And he did that on the weekend. He kicked four goals. Fair Bump, I thought it was probably, you know, the match winner in the end.
And a great day out for him. So clean, and did it when it mattered in the first half, you know, really in that second quarter, particularly when we were just trying to get a little
He's
bit of
got us
confidence
going.
going. Yeah, he really got us happening.
I think you're right about Wright as well, just to throw the two words back to back there, Grizz, because he didn't have a lot of the ball in terms of a big marking effort, but he did have 21 hitouts. So Briggs actually only had 25. So their number one ruckman had 25. Goldstein had 34. So he dominated the ruck. But Wright is giving us something when he goes into the ruck. And I think East Dog's pointed out a couple of times that you don't very often get a second forward who goes for the one goal a game, 10 plus hitouts. Kurt Tippett's the only guy to do that in the last sort of decade, and he did it when he first went to Sydney. So people look at that and go, well, 10 hitouts and the goal's not much of a benchmark, but it's a benchmark players can't seem to clear, and Peter Wright's doing that at the moment.
Yeah, I think we can talk about Peter Wright probably at a different time because there's probably other things to talk about. I just feel like we need to stop looking at him as his output in terms of his goal kicking and scoring stats. What he gives us forward is way sort of more valuable than what Sam Draper or Nick Bryan would give us forward. So even if you're sacrificing a little bit of him playing forward in order to second ruck, you're just getting so much more value in other positions by having an extra small and extra pressure player instead of playing that extra ruck. And so I think functionally we need the real critical sort of strength that Wright brings is as a second ruck. He gives us way more forward, just as a leading sort of type smart and all that sort of stuff than a second ruck would give us. But the other forward we probably need to talk about is Matt Guelfi, who talk about selfless roles. He got on the end of three snags, but his job on Lachie Whitfield was outstanding, really held him quiet and broke him, I think, towards the end. Whitfield just didn't want to defend him, and Guelfi cashed in.
The commentators actually did say that during the game that, Guelfi ran forward and Whitfield was still 20 metres away, standing at the half back looking for the cheap outlet kick. He just didn't want to go to him. And if you'd said to us before the game that Lachie Whitfield was only going to have 18 touches and 270 metres gained, I think everybody would have taken that immediately without even questioning it.
They get players who are just getting off the chain like he does week to week. It's a different game altogether when someone's actually making it really hard for you. And I think it looked like he really mentally struggled with that. And massive credit to Guelfi. But you're just talking about Wright's ability to contribute in a different way. You've got Guelfi playing as a defensive forward and having a game-changing impact on the game. I know there's probably been a bit of talk about Parrish across this year in his bid to stop being just a ball pig and play a much better balanced game. But I reckon there's no coincidence that a few players are starting to contribute on both sides of the ball, and we look a whole heap better for it.
The other player I thought did really well on the weekend and offered something different. So I thought last year when we played the Giants, they beat us up around the midfield. And we've talked about him before and we'll continue to talk about him because he's just been outstanding. But Sammy Durham, you just can't beat us up around the ball at the moment because if you try and do it, he just seems to be this wrecking ball that comes crashing through and smashes the packs. And there were no silly free kicks this week, Grizz. There were no silly 50s.
Oh, thank God.
Which is probably more important for us this week than, say, last week when we were able to get away with it against the West Coast. So, yeah, I just thought that having him in the midfield compared to when we played them last year, in later in the year, when we played late in the year last year, I thought was just a massive difference and a noticeable one as well.
Yeah, and you look at the midfielders, like Sammy Durham, sort of top disposal getter for all our mids with 25, Merritt 24, Perkins 20, Caldwell 20. I think Parrish was probably the lowest at 16. Was you just getting a really balanced output from the midfield at the moment? And Merritt has been racking up 30 plus the last few weeks, but that's just because that's what he does best. But we're getting really even contributions. I just feel like our size profile in the midfield now with Durham and Perkins and Caldwell just looks a bit different than it was with Merritt, Shiel and Parrish. Just like we are bigger around the ball now, which obviously helps, and we've been screaming about for 10 years since Joe Watson. But
Yeah, give us a big midfield, Adrian. That's all we want. Give us a big fucking midfielder for crying out loud.
it turns out it was, pick seven in the draft, and it Perkins and mid-season draft pick and Sammy Darren. But the thing that all those guys have is that they're quick and agile at ground level, and they buy in defensively, and the whole team's buying in defensively at the moment, which is why they're playing well. The other thing I just wanted to touch on, I suppose, is the other side of the field is, which was defensive. We've talked about Laverty in recent weeks, so I probably won't go there. But I thought Ben McKay had an outstanding battle with Jesse Hogan. So Jesse obviously snagged a few early, looked dangerous, but it wasn't quite, you know, Carey and Jakovic, but it was a fairly fun battle there for a while, I thought, watching it.
I think Carey and Jakovic comes in a couple of weeks' time when Ben plays against his brother. but FB, let me ask you this. Do you reckon that Hogan getting on top early was because their midfield was sort of on top of ours early? So we were a little bit loose. We were down by 3 and a bit goals relatively early in the piece, and that was when Jesse sort of was making, you know, you make hay while the sun shines. Once the structure sort of got in place, everyone else around McKay got on top of him. Didn't get on top of Hogan, sorry. Once everyone else around McKay got back into the team structure that we've seen, he just seemed to dominate Hogan again for me.
You're absolutely right. Hogan, you know, he's had a really interesting career where he
that's one word for it. Very interesting.
We'll just kindly say he's underachieved against his talent. But gee, he's got a lot of talent. On his day, he is a very good footballer. And, you know, he had a day out against us late last year, started that way again. And you're right, it was a great battle because I think talent-wise and size-wise, they're a pretty good match. And Hogan had a bit of space to move, plenty of ball in the first quarter and looked very dangerous. But you're right, I reckon the midfield dynamics changed, and that's showed further by GWS's great difficulty kicking a score after half time. And they tend to target Hogan a lot, and they target Green a lot as well. And, you know, one of our much maligned by some medium defenders had a day out on Toby Green, who I know is a little bit out of form. But Grizz, what did you make of Jake Kelly?
Yeah, so Jake Kelly's the sort of guy and sort of player where if he does his job, you don't notice him. If he doesn't do his job, it sticks out because he gets four kicked on him. So he's in a very, not in a great situation in terms of the recognition he gets, but he did a job on Toby Green and he locked him up. As you said, Green hasn't been in the best of form, but guys like Green only need a 5-minute patch, you know, to kick two and set up another and they can turn a game. So I thought he was really good. He had 7 intercept possessions, which again, as a medium, is pretty good. I think it was second or third only to Ben McKay, who had 10 in that moment. But I think Hogan and Green and the rest of the forwards looked really dangerous when the ball was coming in hot early and they had open leading lanes. As soon as Ben McKay was able to play, you know, sort of back shoulder with the ball coming on a bit higher and a bit more ugly with the heat coming on, you know, GWS as they're exiting the 50, they just, you know, Ben McKay was able to use his reach and outmark him, and Kelly was able to, you know, use his height on Toby Green. And just as a whole, I thought the defense worked really well. To keep GWS to 62 points is an unbelievable effort.
There's one thing I do want to quickly ask you guys too about one of our defenders, and that was Nick Martin. Did anybody else notice that pickup he did about 30 seconds before halftime, where he just flicked it up to himself as he was running? That was one of the more impressive things I've ever seen a defender do. It was almost up there with the old incidental mistaken bounce from Courtney Dempsey, except Martin actually meant to do this one. And the commentators didn't even say anything. No, all I could think of was if Bruce or BT or someone like that had been commentating, they probably would have ruined the moment with their over-the-top theatrics. But I thought at the very least it should have got a couple of replays.
He does some truly sublime things. Like, you know, you think back to guys like Blake Carosello who have that sort of effortless, just pristine ball handling ability, and sometimes play just seems to slow down for him. I'm keen to get a take from you guys about his disposal by foot, because we know on his, you know, large parts of each game he's been very good, but we're also seeing a few clangers. Is it because he's racking up a lot of kicks out of, you know, is when you have 20 kicks you make a few mistakes, or is he just biting off too much? Because I thought this weekend was probably one of the examples where those mistakes were probably the balance was a bit out. You know, in the middle of the first quarter, it had a couple of real hack kicks, real miss kicks along the ground, and at least one of them led to a turnover goal. There's a couple of out on the falls in a row later on. So did a lot right, but also, yeah, a few clangers.
I think it comes down to his positional as well. I still think he hasn't quite adjusted to his position in that you can take those risky kicks on when you're forward of centre and you're entering into your forward 50, because if you turn it over, they've got to go the length of the field, and your team, in theory, should be set up enough to be able to stop that. Whereas if you're taking those risky kicks deep in the back line or on the half-back flank, you're not giving your team as much ground between the mistake happens and the opposition goal, I suppose, is the layman's way of explaining it. So to me, I think it comes down to his position. I just don't think he's adjusted, and I don't think he's realised that sometimes he's just got to play within himself. I look at someone like, and I'm not saying he's got the same skills because he clearly doesn't, but you look at someone like Brandon Zerk Thatcher, right, who when he played for us, his first few years, he was abysmal by foot. And that was because he was taking kicks that he just had no right to be taking. Now, he then, once he developed and became a bit more of a player, and you can see it now over at Port, he doesn't kick much more than 20 metres, and it's usually a 45-degree angle or sharper. He's not trying to be this big pinpoint hitting accurate kick. He realises now he can't kick, and that's not his job. So I think Mardo needs to sort of come to that realisation, not that he can't kick, but he doesn't need to be a game-changing kick every time he touches the ball.
I tend to think with players, he takes a good bit of the bad, which is why, you know, I've been seeing from the hymn book of he's 50 metres further up the ground than he needs to be. He needs to be sort of running off half-back, kicking inside 50, as opposed to running off the back line, trying to kick into the middle of the ground. But there's a balance between wanting him to take the right options, but also not wanting to quell the creativity that he brings. Like, he just sees kicks that other people don't see. And so you don't want to quell him taking those kicks, but as Bond says, you want him taking those kicks in the right spots at the right time. And, you know, if he plays wing going inside forward 50, he has more license to take those kicks than, say, doing it from a perspective of when you're inside your back 50, the times in which you can attempt those options are far less. So I think you're sort of going to take the good with the bad, because when it comes off, it's brilliant, but I don't know, maybe it's just further up the ground it needs to be. Is there anything else either of you wanted to touch on this game before?
Just speaking of blokes that can hit a kick, I know we talk about him quite regularly because he's a superstar, but is Zach Merritt the first captain we've had since James Hurd when we're under the pump, we're under the pressure, and you just think, just give him the fucking ball and he will just make sure that something happens? Because I thought he only had about 5 kicks in that third quarter, and I think nearly every single one of them led to some sort of score, because he was just, again, by foot, sensational. And he didn't have his 30 touches like he normally does. As you said earlier, Grizzy, you know, Sammy Durham actually led the midfields to touches. But he just, to me, again, stood out. And at the moment, if he isn't top 5 in the Brownlow, then fuck me, the umpires have got no idea.
Look, he's obviously our best performed player over the entire year. With Zach, I feel like, you know, a bit of recency bias, I feel like Joe Watson, when he was captain, when we absolutely needed something, he was often one to win a crucial clearance, to step up.
Trust him by foot, though. If I had to have somebody kicking for goal for my life, I don't think Joe would be the top 10 players I'd pick from Essendon in the last 10 years.
That's not the point. That's not the question you said. The question was like...
Well, I thought it was, because I said, if we're under pressure, just give him the ball and he'll do something... He'll do something amazing with it. And I don't think Job was the kind of player that did something amazing with it.
No, but when the going was tough and you needed a clearance or you needed someone to step up, generally Job was that player. But, yeah, it's probably different circumstances. All that to say, Zach's obviously had a very good year. He wasn't as prolific as he was on the weekend, but that's just because we're so even across the board and he was still very good. I would be surprised. And, you know, he's played well in our losses and he's played well in our wins, and we've won, 6 games now. So there's at least 5 of those you'd think he'd poll in some regard. So, yeah, he probably would be somewhere up there in the Brownlow at the moment, and he does poll well historically. So who knows? Who knows? We might just move on now to a couple of news items. We'll get into the fixture very quickly and then some injuries before we preview the grand final for North Melbourne this week. So just with the fixture was released from around 16 to 24. Jump online and have a look if you want. The headline for us lads, I feel like, is that of the eight scheduled games, six of them are in prime time Friday night or Saturday night football, with the other games being Sunday MCG, Sunday 3:20 against Fremantle in round 21, and
that 3:20 game is still going to be
Channel 7. It'll be the Channel 7 game, and then there's a Twilight Saturday against St Kilda at Marvel. What do you reckon, boys? So obviously our form to start the year has warranted some extra primetime games. What's your gut feel on the fixture? Do you like it, not like it?
Grizz, I think it's there's a bit of a noise about, you know, GS and it's got a hard run home. That hasn't changed. We're always going to play those opponents. And to me, if we are going to be a final side, playing those teams isn't really a problem. What I like about the fixture for us is that we've got a lot of time at home. You know, there's a trip up to Brisbane in the last round, but otherwise we're camped out in Melbourne, and I feel like if it's going to be a good season and we're going to turn around those sort of poor last 8 to 10 weeks that we've had across the last 3 years, we're in the right place to do it. And you know, I'm excited by the challenge because, you know, I think it's better to make hay while the sun shines, be in a good place after 14 rounds, and then test ourselves and be ready to go if we're going to make the finals.
So I've already quoted him once, and I'm going to quote him again. And he didn't put this on the board. He did put this into a private chat that I'm part of with him for our Supercoach Keeper League. But Heath did also raise the point today that based on the current ladder position to come, we have 18th, 17th, 10th, 7th, 16th, 2nd, 8th, 4th, 12th, 14th, 9th, 10th, 1st, and 13th. That means we have three top six teams, we have five middle six teams, and five bottom six teams. That to me does not scream a difficult draw. Now, I get that percentage thing that came up earlier today that says, oh, based on the add all the percentages together, you know, the Bombers are in trouble. But to me, it just doesn't scream difficult. I guess Collingwood's probably a bit of an outlier there. There's some outliers in there. So, you know, so I think Carlton's eighth at the moment. And so they're in that bottom middle six. And you probably would suggest they would move back into that top six by the end of the year. Or at very least, they're going to be a very difficult side to play. So, you know, you do take that with a little bit of grain of salt. But I just don't think our draw to come is as tough as is being advertised by the media at the moment.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a tough draw, but I was more sort of intimating that there'll be nowhere to hide, I suppose, in the back end of the year because we're going to be on prior time a lot. And round 16, 17, 18 is Geelong, Collingwood, Melbourne back-to-back-to-back at the MCG on prime time. So if we're wanting to make the finals, we'll know by the end of that three-week stretch how we're going, because that's about as tough a three-week gauntlet you get for Melbourne-based games at the moment.
You also imagine that Brisbane game will be in prime time too.
Well, I suppose that with the final round, they generally go with, you know, games that have an implications for finals will be played in prime time, whereas games that probably don't have any bearing on how the finals will play out will get buried in lists. I don't know where Brisbane will be at that point in the year. They've got a lot of the injuries not now at the moment, but it'll be interesting to see.
Sounds to me like you're saying Brisbane definitely won't make the eight. You'll stake your house on it, and they'll be buried. Will be buried on the Sunday twilight time frame.
I would hope neither of those things are true, but that's okay. We'll just quickly jump to injury news now. Not a lot of surprising stuff. Zach Reed and Jai Menzies obviously got through the VFL pretty unscathed on the weekend. Interesting that the club said Jordan Ridley's in line potentially for a return this week against North Melbourne. I find that staggering that after what is essentially 11 weeks off, he would come straight back into the scene. Obviously, it's North Melbourne, so big sort of caveat there. But that's quite startling. He might come straight back into the team. Xavier Duesma's next 5 to 6 weeks have come up with a more concrete timeline there with a tear to his quad, and Sam Draper had surgery this week. He'll miss the next 6 to 8. Anything sort of notable there, boys, that you want to talk about before we get into the North Melbourne game?
I feel like a quad is one of those. I feel like a quad's a different injury to a hamstring.
Yeah.
Picture a cold, windy, rough VFL ground, running around. Not that the VFL surface is too bad.
Yeah.
You get the point. You know, I just, you know, I feel like if he's okay to play, he's as likely to re-injure a quad anywhere. You know, whereas sometimes some of those, you know, I find hamstring injuries, even calf, under the extra load of an AFL game, you can picture guys kind of getting fatigued and being at higher risk. But I don't know if he's okay to play, which is the big question mark. He is probably in that top section of the list where you almost bring him straight back in.
Yeah, but yeah, your last point there is exactly what I was going to say. For me, Ridley's one of those players that you just don't play in the VFL. If he's fit, he's fit and he plays AFL, because you play him in our VFL at the moment, he's going to be chasing the ball all day. He'll get 60 touches and he'll get leather poisoning and be out for another 6 weeks. So I think Jordan Ridley is in that very select elite group where you just don't play them in the VFL at, under any circumstances. Zach Reed, I would be surprised if he plays much more VFL. I reckon they'll bring him in, and I think Jaden will probably be the one that comes out as he was the odd man out at the start of the year when Reed was playing. Again, similar to what you've just sort of said there, Fair Bump, is the VFL is a little bit of a different quality. It's a little bit colder. The grounds are a little bit wetter. I'd be much more comfortable having him indoors in the comfort of Docklands. The Draper one, it was something that we did talk about earlier when we were talking about how Goldstein was doing so well and right to that second ruck. It does feel a little bit like maybe the Draper one's a blessing in disguise, because it just means that we don't have to have that conversation for the next 8 to 10 weeks, because I still don't think you can play Draper, Wright, Stringer, Jones and Goldstein all in the same. I just think it's too top heavy. I don't count Langford in that. I think he's okay mobility-wise, but I just think it's too top-heavy, and I think this injury means we just don't have to have that awkward conversation yet, because I don't know if Goldstein's the one we drop, which is a little bit awkward for somebody like Sam Draper, given where he's in his career. He'd probably want to be pushing Todd Goldstein out if we were forced to have that conversation.
Yeah, and I think the forward pressure we had on the weekend against the Giants probably tells you what having one less tall, one more small can do for the team's sort of overall
exactly
balance.
Exactly right.
I think one of Zach Reed or Jordan Ridley plays VFL this week. I don't think you can bring both of them in at once. But so I think if Ridley's fit, he probably comes in, Zach gets another week at VFL level. But
yeah, that's fair. That's a good call. That's a
cool. But we'll move now to just quickly touch on the North Melbourne game. I jokingly called it North's grand final this week, because I know there's a lot of talk about how poor North Melbourne are going at the moment, and they're not going very well. And I know there are a lot of people posters sort of happy to see it at the moment, but I don't think this is going to be as close as big a blowout as people think. And it just comes down to this old adage I remember, which is that you can't fake desperation. And North are desperate. They haven't got a win. There's every chance they'll go into their round 11 bye or round 12 bye, you know, with zero wins, 11 losses. They get up for this matchup every year. It's their grand final. We joke about it, but sort of the club itself and North supporters sort of admit this is the game that they circle. And, you know, we talked about it after the West Coast game, Bonts, which was, teams like North and like West Coast circle us as a game that they might be able to snag, because generally we give them a chance to win it. So I reckon they'll be up for this. And if we're not careful, it'll be closer than it should be.
You got to include the Clarko factor as well, because
yeah.
So removing North Melbourne as an entity for a moment, remember where Clarko's come from as a coach. He came from Hawthorn, and we do genuinely hate Hawthorn. There is a genuine hatred between those two clubs. Line in the sand and all that sort of crap happened, you know, not whilst Clarko was looking on. So really, you do sort of look at that and go, well, it does add to it, doesn't it? Just adds that little bit of spice.
Was line in the hand?
Maybe he was a year later.
He was definitely the unsociable Hawks, which is what they'll be bringing. I think we'll see unsociable North on the weekend. Absolutely.
Yeah. And look, I'll be honest. I don't. I, I don't really care. The weekend. I'm sorry. I just don't care. I mean, I look at Cam Zerhow, and I said this on the board today, and some people have laughed at me for saying it, but, you know, I mean, Cam Zerhow's their second best four behind Nick Larke at the moment. And I'm not convinced that Cam Zerhow's best 22 for more than a half a dozen clubs in the AFL. I just don't think he's a good player. I think because you got the old adage there of, oh, well, he's kicked goals in a poor side, so therefore if you put him in a good side, the reality is, even in a poor team, somebody has to kick the goals, and especially at AFL level, because you're not going. Somebody has to kick a goal. You can't. No team in the AFL is going to go through scoreless. It just doesn't happen. So the fact that he's managed to kick a few goals for the bottom team, to me, isn't a reflection of his ability. It's more of a reflection on the fact that there's nobody else in that side that can kick goals. So. Anyway, but that's not just about Cam Zerhow. Now Nick Larkey's all right, but I think Mackay will cover him. Zeri's a good ruckman. He does well for my super coach. But I'm not too sure Goldstein's going to be worried about him. I mean, Goldstein got dropped for him last year and then probably took the spot back about 2 weeks later. LDU looks like he's already looking for his paycheck. And then outside of that, I don't think I could probably name another North player off the top of my head.
So dismissive, Bonds. I like it. And I think Zerhow is a good example of what you were talking about, Grizz, which is Zerhow's, you know, a number of his best games have come against us because they're his grand final. And so that, you know, that happens across the boards. Clubs, everyone's looking for a scalp. If you're in a team that's only going to win a few games a year, you definitely try and figure out which ones might be. And undoubtedly, they'll have a go. I think for mine, they just lack quality. So I think they will come out. I think they will be unsociable. What I've seen so far from the Bombers this year has been consistency. Two quarters against Port, I thought the Sydney game was a good effort. So I can't help but feel that Essendon will turn up and probably see off an early onslaught and win easily. Maybe not a blowout, but my hot tip is about Archie Perkins actually having a bit of a breakout game, because I feel like he's in pretty good form, and there's a lot of guys like Durham and Caldwell having a moment in the sun, and I feel like Perkins is going well, but it's the sort of game that it could really open up and he could end up with 4 or 5 and more than 25 touches. So that's my tip for this weekend.
Yeah, and I think with this game, North Melbourne, the last two times we've played them, have gotten close because they've dominated the clearances. Now, the clearances is sort of our forte at the moment. So I think the key to this game would just be if we can break even just on the clearances, which we should do just on form, but North generally are a decent clearance team considering midfielders where they've sort of, most of their draft picks have been. But they're missing, I think, George Wardlaw this week. So that's a big loss for them. But I think if we can break even in the clearances, we'll beat them on the outside. They haven't got the class or the running power at the moment just because they're so young to match us on the outside. But my big tip, I think, is I think Cole Langford might have a day out here. I don't know if they have a matchup for him inside defensive 50. He's too good overhead for Luke McDonald. I think he's far too mobile for Aiden Core. I think if we can get the ball going forward often enough, he got a day out.
I'll be honest. I should have said I did know George Wardlaw. And to be honest, Chris, I reckon George Wardlaw sums up my point beautifully, because the bloke averages 17 touches a game as an inside mid. So, which is good for a second-year player, don't get me wrong. But is it somebody concerned about at this stage of his career, getting 17 touches as an inside mid?
He played pretty well against us last year. He took us to the cleaners in that first game.
Yeah, he played okay. I don't know, mate. Maybe I am being a bit too dismissive, but I don't know. It's North. I'm not too stressed. And you know, when we win by 85 points, I'll come back on next week and tell you that I tipped it again like I did last week with GWS.
All right. Well, we might just do that now. We might do a tip, a margin, and a prediction. So I've already said my prediction to FB. I think it'll be the Bombers by 5 goals. I think Cole Langford will kick 6. Fairbunt, what's your tick? Your tip? And we know Perkins is your bold prediction.
Yeah, I reckon it's going to be in the realm of 10 goals, 65 points. If you want to put a number on it, I think Wright, Langford, Perkins will. if we're going to put some of these sides away and stop struggling with cellar dwellers, it's got to be a few guys kicking some goals. So this could be the week.
Bond quickly.
Yeah, no, 85. I'm sticking by my 85, and I think Todd Goldstein will give the North crowd the shush after he kicks a goal from the boundary line.
Well, that would be good. So that'll wrap us up for this week. As always, guys, thanks for attending, and thanks for joining us tonight. And if you're listening, thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, and tell your some supporting mates. Go Bombers.